The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Peter Sheldahl has been described as America's most influential writer on art. And in the decade he has written his weekly column in the New York, in the New Yorker, he has taken us to exhibitions around the world and challenged us to ask, "What is beauty?" Born in Fargo, North Dakota, Mr. Sheldahl began his career as a reporter in the Midwest. Then, as an inspiring poet, he moved to New York City, where a fluke phone call started his career in art criticism, writing for a variety of publications, including Art News, The New York Times, and The Village Voice. He is a recipient of numerous awards for art criticism, including the Frank Jewett Mather Award, and this year the Clark Prize for Excellence in Arts Writing. He also received a Guggenheim Fellowship for poetry. He has published a number of books of poetry as well as on art criticism, including The Hydrogen Jukebox, a frank and opinionated collection of essays on modern art. His new book, Let's See, Writings on Art from the New Yorker, is a collection of 75 essays, some of which he has revisited and even changed his initial opinion or review. He covers everything from antiquities to contemporary art and reconsiders some of his favorites. Happily, Philadelphia's Thomas Aiken stands up to his close scrutiny. Our second guest is Edward Dolnick, who won the 2006 Edgar Award for Best Fact Crime for The Rescue Artist, his rollicking account of the theft of Edward Munch's The Scream in a daring robbery in 1984. Mr. Dolnick is a former chief science writer for the Boston Globe, whose other books include Down the Great Unknown and Madness on the Couch. He is a contributor to The Atlantic Monthly, The New York Times Magazine, and many other publications. His new book, The Forger's Spell, A True Story of Vermeer Nazis and the Greatest Art Hoax of the 20th Century, tells a true story of an unknown painter, Han von Mergerin, who forged Vermeer's paintings so well they sold for millions of dollars. The Los Angeles Times describes his work as follows. In the story of a two-bit Dutch painter, Han von Mergerin, who had nerve to take on the most rarefied of his artistic compatriots, Johann Vermeer, author Edward Dolnick has hit the mother lode. We are honored to have them here with us today. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Peter Sheldahl and Edward Dolnick to our culturally rich community.
Well, thank you very much for that, and thank you for coming. What a crowd, gee. I'm going to talk about art forgery tonight. I'll tell a story, try to set the scene, which will take 5 or 6 minutes, and then, gods of technology permitting, I'll show some slides and talk about them for 15 minutes or so, and then I hope there'll be some questions later on. So, it's 1945, we're in Europe, World War II has just ended. One of the ways the Nazis spent the war years was stealing art. They stole on a massive, almost unfathomable scale from private collections, from museums, whatever they wanted. One reason for the theft is that both Hitler and Hermann Göring, the number one and the number two men in Nazi Germany, fancied themselves art connoisseurs. Göring in particular literally had private trains emptying out art from across Europe and heading back to his country homes in Germany. Tens of thousands of paintings and sculptures, hardly anything modern, but aside from that, all the great names, Rembrandt and Titian and Raphael, all gathered up and brought home for him. When the war ended, Hitler and Göring both scrambled desperately to hide their stolen art. The Americans found Göring's collection in May 1945 in the Bavarian Alps. The soldiers going through the paintings, one picture in particular catches their eye. They don't know the painting itself, but they know the name of the artist. It's Johannes Vermeer. It turns out that this painting is a particular prize of Goering's. For this single picture, he had traded 137 looted pictures from his collection in order to get this one. The Nazis were as meticulous in their record-keeping when it came to art as they were about everything else. So this Vermeer came with paperwork. On such and such a date, this person sold the painting on to that person. One of the names in this paperwork is a small-time Dutch art dealer named Han van Meegeren. He lives in Amsterdam. Turns out he lives in quite a palatial mansion in Amsterdam. So in May 1945, the Dutch police come knocking on van Meegeren's door. They say they've got just a couple of questions. It ought to only take a minute or two. They're certain he can clear things up quickly. What they want to know is how it was that he came to be involved in the sale of a Vermeer. I should say that the Dutch police had scarcely any interest in art or in Vermeer. What brought them to this was that the Dutch had suffered terribly during the war, although a tiny number had managed to thrive. It looked as if van Meegeren was one of these who had done quite well for himself. And so what the police were after was to find out what that was about. Had he collaborated with the Germans? Had he been in cahoots with them in some way? What was the deal here? And so they asked him, expecting a routine answer. And to the surprise of the police, when they asked, how did you get involved with the sale of this Vermeer? Van Meegeren doesn't have much of an answer. He hems and haws, and he comes up with a kind of vague and cockamamie story. The picture belonged to a wealthy family he knew. They'd fallen on hard times. They wanted to raise some money. They didn't want anyone to know about their predicament. They asked him if he would help, and out of kindness, he said he would. And the police say, okay, when was that? What was the name of the family? He can't remember. It's been a long while. He'd love to help. The police do such important work. He's terribly sorry. It slipped his mind. The police march him off to jail in the hope that will jog his memory. It doesn't. 2 weeks go by, nothing. 4 weeks. At about the six-week mark, the Dutch police come back to van Meegeren in his jail cell, and they tell him, we've been thinking about this. And as we mull the case over, it strikes us that this isn't a case essentially about theft. What went on is that in time of war, you took a national treasure of the Dutch people and you sold it to a mortal enemy of the state. This is war. That's treason. And the penalty for treason, the police say, is death. At this point, van Meegeren's memory improves markedly. And before the police can turn to leave, he calls them over to him. I've got something to say that you're going to be interested in, he says. So the police crowd into van Meegeren's jail cell. He's just a little fellow. He's a dapper little man. He's there. The police are there. And now he starts jumping up and down like Rumpelstiltskin, screaming at the police. Fools, he shouts. I didn't steal that Vermeer I sold to Goering. I painted it myself. The police roll their eyes. Nobody has mentioned forgery to this point. It's a case of theft. And they don't. Their initial reaction is not to believe it. He's facing a crime that carries a death penalty. Naturally, you'd come up with this far-fetched story about forgery, which is presumably going to carry as penalty a stern lecture from a judge. The police aren't inclined to believe this. But van Meegeren's not done. He's still screaming at them. He says, do you remember that Vermeer in Rotterdam a few years ago that everybody said was the greatest Vermeer of them all? I painted that one too. And the one that the National Museum bought last year for $1 million. Mine too. And he rattles off the names of four or five other Vermeers, all of them discovered within the past few years, all of them sold for millions of dollars. And according to van Meegeren, all of them his work. So the police don't know what to make of this. They go off. They leave him in his jail cell. A day or two go by. The police presuming that this can't possibly be so. And over the course of those days, the police begin to ask themselves if there's any chance at all that he could have been telling the truth. And one of them has a bright idea. He says, if Van Meegeren painted a Vermeer once, he could do it again, except this time we'll watch. And that's what happens. They set him up at his easel with his paints, this time an armed guard behind him. They tell us, and they tell him, paint a Vermeer. By now, word has leaked out to the Dutch papers. One of them runs a headline that says, he paints for his life. So, that's the setup of our story. But there's a twist in the tale, and it's a twist that sets this story of forgery apart from all others. And the twist is that these were truly dreadful paintings. And yet they were hailed as not only Vermeers, but as the greatest Vermeers of all. Art critics and the public looked at Quasimodo and they saw Adonis. That's what's the heart of this story. Let me see if we can see some pictures. This is Han van Meegeren at about the time of his arrest. He was 56. He had been an unsuccessful serious artist, then a fairly successful commercial painter, then a hugely successful forger. He was a big spender, a big drinker, a connoisseur of old masters and young women. There were all sorts of rumors about where the money had come from. Some people thought he had won the French National Lottery. Some people thought he had won it twice. He was a good businessman, a brilliant psychologist. What he wasn't especially good at was painting. He found a way to make that not matter very much. This is Goering in the middle, as I say, number two in Nazi Germany. He's head of the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force. Hitler at his side. This is Goering in his dressing room. Goering was a man of astonishing, jaw-dropping vanity. He designed his own uniforms. He changed them four or five times a day. At parties, he would show up in outfits that he had designed himself. Once in a toga with those kind of slippers where the toes curl up, dripping in rings and jewelry. Someday, he said, there will be a statue of Hermann Goering in every home in Germany. This is a cartoon from The New Yorker, 1943. This is Goering. Goering looked like a buffoon, and often he acted like one. But it's important to bear in mind that this was a terribly dangerous man. He's a mass killer without a shred of conscience, utterly convinced that whatever he wants, he's entitled to. Quite often what he wants is art. Here's one more player in the story. This is Abraham Bradius. In the early part of the last century, he's one of the eminent experts on Vermeer and on Dutch old masters in particular. He's genuinely talented and also a complete bag of wind. Vain, bad-tempered, quarrelsome. If you once cross him, you have in Bradius an enemy for life. But he had a track record that nobody could match. He felt he had a pipeline to Vermeer. He could recognize a Vermeer in the way that you recognize your spouse's voice on the phone. He knew it at once. He knew it immediately. He knew it beyond the possibility of error. There are only 35 Vermeers in the world, 36 by some counts. Bradius had found three of them, three of that tiny number, at the time attributed to other painters. So there was a basis for the self-confidence. But he'd made those discoveries around 1900. Our story set three decades later. 1900, he'd been in his 50s. He'd been in his prime. Now 30 years have passed. He's in semi-retirement, desperate to cap his career with one final triumph that will make the world remember his name. I can't show you a picture of Vermeer because we don't have one. We have no idea what he looked like, if he was tall or short or skinny or fat. We don't have a scrap of writing about his art from him. We don't know what it was that he intended to achieve in the paintings. We don't know if he thought he had succeeded or failed. All we have is the pictures themselves, the tiny number, as I say, 35. In comparison, we have, say, 350 Rembrandts, more or less. And that kind of number is typical of everybody in the era. So a giant question is why so few? Why only 35? Where are the others? Are there others? Nobody knows. Everything about Vermeer is shrouded in mystery. His biography, it's like Shakespeare, almost a complete blank, which for art historians is a source of endless frustration. But for a swindler, those blanks in the record are an invitation to come in. Girl with the Pearl Earring is probably nowadays Vermeer's most famous painting. It turned up in 1881. Where it had been for the two centuries before that, nobody knows. When it did turn up, it was without any fanfare. It turned up at a provincial auction. It didn't rate a mention in the auction catalog. If the picture had a name, nobody knew it. The fellow who bought it paid what would be $200 in today's money. I'm not going to talk about the picture as a picture, except to point out the blue and the yellow, Vermeer's favorite colors. They turn up in Vermeer after Vermeer. This, on the other hand, is a Van Meegeren painting in his own name. Here's another. This one is called Blowing Bubbles. This kind of kitschy magazine illustration painting is the kind of thing he does in the middle years of his career, which these were commercially successful. He was making money. He didn't get any critical respect. For that matter, he didn't get any critical disdain. These weren't worth talking about at all. As a young man, he'd been much more ambitious as an artist. Painted quite seriously. The critics had trashed that serious work. He had had, when he was young, a show of religious paintings, a one-man show, and the critics went on and on. The pictures were maudlin and insipid and saccharine and sicky sweet. One of them, I should say, at this religious show, which came in for all the as much condemnation as any of the others, was a biblical painting called Christ at Emmaus. And as I say, the same reception, sicky sweet, impossible to take. So here is our forger's challenge. This is what his work looks like when he's painting in his own name. He's decided he's going to pass himself off as Vermeer. It's going to be a challenge. As it happened, Han van Meegeren's studio was about 30 miles up the road from where Bradius lived in retirement in Monaco. Bradius, the great Vermeer scholar that we saw a minute ago. One day in the summer of 1937, van Meegeren sends a middleman carrying an enormous package to knock on Bradius' door. And what he has in the package is a picture, this picture, which was called Christ at Emmaus. It had a big Vermeer signature in the dark area in the left, which has faded over the years. Christ at Emmaus. You remember that Van Meegeren had painted a Christ at Emmaus, and the critics had panned it. Nobody panned this picture. The critics were bowled over by its beauty. Bradius, in particular, immediately hails it as a Vermeer. He's rhapsodic. He has found the painting that will cap his 80s with one last find. He races off to the Burlington Magazine, the leading art magazine of the day, and he writes an article that has the headline, A New Vermeer. And he starts out, "It is a wonderful moment in the life of a lover of art when he finds himself suddenly confronted with a hitherto unknown painting by a great master, untouched on the original canvas, just as it left the painter's studio. We have here the masterpiece of Johannes Vermeer." And it wasn't just Bradius. Nearly all the critics join in. They talk about the painting's serenity and its tranquility and the infinite beauty of the faces and the melting quality of the light. When art books on Vermeer come out, this is the picture that they put on the cover. The museum in Rotterdam buys it almost at once, $4 million. They They have it as the center of a blockbuster exhibition. The Dutch line up by the thousands, reverentially before it. In fact, Time magazine reviewed the show, and they talked about how they said in the article that the Dutch liked to look at their best paintings in a reverential hush. And so many people were coming to see it that their shoes were squeaking on the wooden floor, which ruined the solemnity. So the museum put carpeting in front so you would have the proper mood. This painting quickly became one of the most admired pictures in the world. From 1937, when it was unveiled, until 1945, when the police come knocking on Van Meegeren's door, if someone said Vermeer, this is the picture you think of. In the way that today, if someone says Leonardo da Vinci, you think of the Mona Lisa. The much greater painting than Girl with the Pearl Earring or The Milkmaid or any of the others. So what would make anyone think Vermeer when they look at this? Well, the signature didn't hurt. There were a couple of Vermeer touches. There's the blue and the yellow. There's the light from a window on the left, although Vermeer never painted such a crude window. But more important than that was the time. This is 1937. Europe is in terrible trouble. The Nazis are already in power. It's plain to everyone that war is looming. And then comes this picture by one of the most revered Dutch masters. And what he's revered for is the mood of quiet and calm. Here in this era when Europe is about to explode in flame is a newfound picture by Vermeer that becomes for the Dutch an emblem of those values that are most threatened in the looming catastrophe. So this is a kind of unspoken rebuke to the Germans. This shows what the Dutch hold dear. And they revere this painting. This is the forgery that made all the others possible. That was 1937. In the meantime, war does come along. In 1940, the Nazis invade Holland. Holland is in terrible trouble. Anne Frank and her fellow Jews are taken off to concentration camps and killed. Those Dutch who aren't killed outright are forced into slave labor. The Dutch are dying of cold. They're dying of starvation. They're ransacking bombed buildings, trying to yank out pieces of wood to burn for heat. They're chopping down trees in their parks for firewood. There isn't even enough wood left to make coffins to bury the dead. They're burying the dead wrapped in blankets or in cardboard. In these terrible times, with everything in short supply, an enormous black market springs up. Essentially, the only thing the Dutch have in abundance is art. And they go running to every storeroom and attic in the country looking for the kind of picture that the Nazis like. And the Germans have money in abundance. It's stolen money. It's state money. They're perfectly willing to pay high prices for these newfound trophies. So you have rushing toward one another these desperate sellers and these eager buyers, and it makes for this price frenzy for art. And making matters worse, making the frenzy all the more heated, you have a handful of Dutch industrialists as well who have hung on to their money and are desperately throwing their millions at these same paintings, doing what they can to keep these Dutch masterpieces out of the hands of their Nazi overlords. It's a wonderful time to be a forger. And indeed, although only a handful of Vermeers have ever appeared over the course of three centuries, now they begin popping up like flowers after the rain. Half a dozen in half a dozen years, as I say. All of them on these biblical lines. So this, bear in mind, is a Vermeer. Actually, a Van Meegeren, of course, but sold as a Vermeer. It's called Isaac Blessing Jacob. It looks as if it should be called Isaac Giving Jacob a Karate Chop. We've got blue, yellow, not much else. $6 million. This is Goering's Vermeer. This is Christ with the woman taken in adultery. from the Bible story, let him who was without sin cast the first stone. Goering said this was the most expensive painting in his collection. These pictures don't look anything like Vermeer's. You might have thought that people would look at them and say, these pictures don't look anything like Vermeer's. I wonder if maybe they're not Vermeer's. No one reasoned that way. People said, these pictures don't look anything like Vermeer's. Therefore, Vermeer had depths to him that we never suspected. He was an even greater master than we had believed. After the truth came out, Van Meegeren's dupes sounded dazed, almost bewildered. They were like the people who go to a hypnotist show. And afterward, when the hypnotist snaps his fingers, they can't believe that a minute before they were waltzing around the stage with a broomstick and gazing lovingly into their partner's eyes. How did so many people go so wrong? We'll look at a comparatively good one by way of relief. Let me wrap up by talking ever so briefly about that. The book I wrote, The Forger's Spell, is about art and about art history, but just as much it's about psychology, because the psychology is every bit as important in getting this con to work as the art was. The first brilliant thing that Van Meegeren did was not try to paint a near copy of a Vermeer. That would have been the standard technique. That's what everybody else does. You would have expected him to paint a girl with two pearl earrings or some such. He wasn't good enough to get away with that. He couldn't have stood the comparison. What he did instead is take advantage of the blanks in Vermeer's career and invent a new kind of Vermeer, this kind. And once he got away with it the first time, he continued to mine that same vein. And the other thing he did that was quite clever, he took advantage of the art experts' expectations. There had been any number of articles written over the years by Bradius and by others about why so few Vermeers and what a new one would look like in the fortunate event that a new one was found. And often they were quite specific. Mark my words, someday a new picture will turn up and it will have this trait and that trait and the other trait. Van Meegeren reads these same articles, except he takes them as a to-do list, turns out pictures that have this trait and that trait and the other trait, has his middlemen run them under the nose of the experts who say, it's just as I said. And then, when it was all over, Van Meegeren asked a question. Yesterday, this picture was worth millions of guilders, he said, this picture. And experts and art lovers would come from all over the world and pay money to see it. Today it's worth nothing, and nobody would cross the street to see it for free. But the picture hasn't changed. What has? Let's stop there. Thank you.
Nothing technical. I'm not giving you anything to look at. I tried to wear a nice tie. and I'm here to push my book, which is this, and that's me on the cover. So, I thought maybe I'd read something from it. Generally, I don't like to lecture. I don't understand lectures. I think it's because I dropped out of college and I slept through the few that I went to. that is, I understand writing and I understand talking. And lecturing seems to me to be a combination of sloppy writing and tight-ass talking. But anyway, so what I really like is question and answer, but I'm told that's been arranged, so I can't start out. I like to say I'm a big-time art critic from New York. What do you want to know? And then... And then take the incoming. But that you'll just have to wait, and it won't be very long. I'm gonna do this quickly. And I thought, well, what should I read? And I thought, well, I'm going through. I could get a vote whether you want to hear about Rembrandt or Hitler or I wrote about Hitler as an artist. Buy the book. You can read it. It's great. I also wrote about Vermeer. in suite to that fascinating lecture about Van Meegeren, I've seen that painting in Rotterdam, and it really is shocking. Although, as I was looking at it on the screen for a long time, it started to look kind of cool. You know, I thought, you know, maybe Vermeer didn't paint that, but maybe he should have. And if he did, you know, I think, trample on somebody else's turf. Anyway, what was it about Johannes Vermeer? Everyone idolizes the elusive Dutchman who made silence-drenched small pictures, paintings, mostly of unremarkable domestic scenes in the tidy city of Delft almost 3.5 centuries ago. He died in 1675 at the age of 43. Certainly his work is beautiful, but in unsettling ways that sheer away from the subjects of the pictures. The mighty red of the hat in Girl with a Red Hat confounds like a shocking comment made in polite company, which only you appear to have heard. The play of sunlight on the collar and cowl of the girl in Young Woman with a Water Pitcher also jolts. It could be the secret of life, but when you try to call attention to it, you stammer. With Vermeer, our eyes and minds squabble over what they are beholding. Is it image or paint, realism or reality? We may catch the artist out in tricks, noting, for instance, apparent effects of a camera obscura, variable focus, puddled light, and details whose incredible accuracy owes nothing to traditional technique. But Vermeer beggars any analysis. There is a discomfort, a prickling itch in my experience of him. Looking and looking, I always feel I have only begun to look. Vermeer is blatant and ineffable, like the Sphinx. His appeal is both populist and lofty, as if he mixed Norman Rockwell with the music of the spheres. He intoxicates not only art historians and art critics, but no end of novelists and poets. And his stock, never depressed in the 20th century, is on the rise. I think that our renewed enthusiasm for Vermeer confirms a trend in current taste away from art as a field of educational improvement and toward aesthetic experience as an end in itself. We are revaluing painterly rhetoric of light and color. We have decided that we don't mind being manipulated by artists. In fact, we require it. We demand to be taken out of ourselves. No artist erases self-consciousness faster than Vermeer. Very little is known about him, but in Anthony Bailey's supple new biography, Vermeer, Then and Now, A View of Delft, which I recommend, that little goes a long way. Connecting sparse dots, Bailey works up a highly plausible account of the master's life and career. The book perfectly complements a major loan exhibition at the Metropolitan Vermeer and the Delft School. Included are 15 of Vermeer's 35 generally accepted canvases, masses of work by other artists, and much documentation of 17th century Delft, a walled and canal-watered town of 25,000. Many Vermeer fans, who might regard the show as just a few jewels packed in scholarly bubble wrap, will plunge directly into the crumbs of fellow viewers around Woman with a Balance, The Art of Painting, and the rest. I recommend initial absorption in, at minimum, the works of Carl Fabricius and Pieter de Hooch, painters who are cherishable in their own right and crucial as influences for mere regularly cribbed motifs from de Hooch in particular. Bailey begins his biography with the explosion of about 45 tons of gunpowder in an arsenal in 1654. The accident leveled a good bit of Delft and killed Fabricius, a 32-year-old former pupil of Rembrandt and Delft's best painter, who would definitely be among the greats if he had lived, I think. At the Met, an astonishing little Fabricius painting of a goldfinch perched against a yellow wall points straight ahead to the mature style of Vermeer, who was 22 in 1654. A eulogistic poem that appeared 13 years later consoled Delft for the loss of Fabricius by citing Vermeer, who masterfully trod his path. In some copies of the poem, the last line ends with, "who proved to be as great a master." Bailey speculates that personal diplomacy by Vermeer brought about the upgrade. No one can doubt that the maker of the art of painting, a masterpiece's masterpiece, showing a painter portraying a model who is done up as Cleo, the muse of history, thirsted for glory. Vermeer's only moderately successful career bespeaks the perfectionism that made him the worst enemy of his own ambition, and not just by keeping his output so small. Bailey reports that Dutch painters then averaged about 50 paintings a year. Vermeer's rate was 2 or 3. Here was an artist, quote, impatient to be found out, to be seen, Bailey writes, but so principled that he kept painting himself out of his art. He became, quote, the person who has just left the room or is expected at any moment. Did compunction drive him crazy? In his later years, he painted less often and less well. Having fallen into a state of, quote, decay and decadence, in the recorded words of his wife, Katharina Bolms, he suffered some kind of collapse and went, quote, in a day and a half from being healthy to being dead. The son of an innkeeper who was also an art dealer, Vermeer must have grown up around beer-swilling painters. He became a dealer himself. The Dutch Golden Age was a commercial enterprise. Katharina bore him 15 children and drew him into her Catholicism, a religion that was intermittently suppressed in Delft at the time. A weird late painting in the show, Allegory of the Faith, reeks of hysterical piety. It is one of two large un-Vermeerish Vermeers that bracket the artist's great period. The other, done when he was 24, is The Procuress, an unfamiliar picture from Dresden that shows a lewd cavalier pawing a complacent prostitute as a leering procuress looks on and a lute player, possibly Vermeer himself, hilariously carouses. It is a jumble of elements, some of which are stunning. The abrupt realism of the procuress's face suggests an actual woman looking out through a hole in the canvas, and the sonorous yellow of the prostitute's dress sets off an eruption of beauty. Isn't Vermeer the painter of yellow, just as Rembrandt is of browns, Velázquez of pink and gray, and Goya of black? No one else, except sometimes Van Gogh, wrings more eloquence from the sunshine hue. The goatishness of the procuress and the frenzy of Allegory of the Faith expose extreme emotions that were soft-pedaled in Vermeer's major work, nearly all of which is erotic and spiritual at once, but mutedly. The art of painting is a philosophical picture, like Velázquez's nearly contemporaneous Las Meninas, though on a pocket scale. Sitting with his back to us, the doodadup painter, who, like the lute player in The Procuress, has shoulder-length brown hair, starts to paint the laurel headdress of the glowing young model who holds a trombone and a large book. The two are framed on the left by a cluttered table, an empty chair, and drapery whose pattern echoes the leaves in the headdress, both on the model and in the painter's rendering, building a sense of a metaphysical laurel grove. The drapery establishes the viewer's space at a shadowy remove from the scene. Of course, our viewpoint is precisely that of the painter of the art of painting. As we ponder all this, the work melts us with a subtle plangent triad of the primary colors, yellow book, bluish leaves on the canvas, the painter's red stockings. I wonder if the healthy-minded Dutch, while admiring Vermeer's skill, didn't find something intolerably neurotic about him. In any case, his art slipped into an obscurity that was compounded by its scarcity and later by tangled misattributions. French enthusiasts rediscovered him in the mid-19th century. Bailey notes Marcel Proust's famous excursion in 1921, the year before he died, to see the artist's view of Delft at the Jeu de Paume in Paris. Proust wrote that experience into La Recherche du Temps Perdu. The writer Bergotte, who is gravely ill, imagines his own whole life in balance with a little patch of yellow wall in the painting. Moments later, he falls dead. It is a terminal epiphany like the ignited consciousness of Anna Karenina under the train. Though Proust carefully leavens it with irony, Bergotte's final thought is of undercooked potatoes. The passage sets a sacramental seal on Vermeer's art as a shrine of artistic devotion. You would think that veneration so exquisite, verging on the epicene, indicates an object of well-recherché taste. But anyone with eyes can go goofy over this or that little patch of something in Vermeer. A skeptical friend of mine surmises that our present Vermeer craze reflects yearnings for legitimacy in today's lately expanded upper middle class. This makes sense. You might say that Vermeer apotheosizes material prosperity, not that he was ever well off himself. If only because of that horde of kids underfoot, his golden views of bourgeois serenity had to be vicarious. I think that Vermeer's ideal was a classless, timeless myth that is returning to the fore in contemporary culture, the essential role that ascetic pleasure must live in any seriously lived life. Each of us is born with a capacity to see and feel intensely and with precision. Ultimately, Vermeer's appeal is about nothing other than the realization of that gift. Looking at his pictures, we approach the farthest frontiers of a necessary happiness. Anyway, that's... Okay. Vermeer, me too. By the way, I had a pleasant afternoon driving over from New York, and I don't know if I should mention this, on the radio listening to my baseball team win a game over your baseball team. Don't worry, your baseball team is scary, scary great, and I don't think. Anyway, but so we've got one day of being in first place. This feels great. All right. And also I went by the museum and visited old friends. I mean, the Roger van der Weyden, which is one of the half dozen best pictures in the planet. And the little self-portrait by Tintoretto, which which I want to steal and take home with me. Philadelphia has always been a painting town. It's one of the great, great painting towns, as opposed to Boston, which is blind as a mole. But thinks a lot, and wins the World Series twice a century. Peter, stop it. I'm going to read one more, and then we'll go down. We'll go down. We'll go. The whole thing will fall to pieces. Is what's going to happen. But, okay. I thought maybe it'd be a little entertaining. It's fairly short. It's actually the first column I wrote for The New Yorker after I was hired in November 1998. And somebody said, Peter, I noticed whenever you're scared, you seem to be funny. So I don't know. But, of course, now that I've told you it's funny, it's going to be horrible, isn't it? Okay. Fairies. Take the word Victorian out of Victorian fairy painting, the title of an exhibition at the Frick in New York, and you have a redundancy. All painting is fairy painting, materialized visions of immaterial entities that are possessed of some spirit or another. Even the starkest abstract painting maintains in its rectangle a rule of sorcery by which appearance trumps logic and imagination is common sense. We enjoy that if we like painting. Do we like the paintings in this honey-sweet, hemlock-dripping show? We needn't very much, I think, to find them usefully fascinating. Mostly from the mid-19th century, the oils, watercolors, and whatnot, including a toy theater, memorialize a British craze for gossamer critters, which, in the Victorian way, exudes psychosocial wooziness and a remorseless will to charm. To be brief about it, this stuff is the living last word in antique tweed. And yet it feels on time for us. Some of the most interesting younger painters in New York have lately been making figurative, fantasy-driven, small-scale pictures that suggest fairy commando raids on dull convention. I think of John Curran's Freakish Women and Elizabeth Peyton's Swoony Rock Stars, images that, like conjured fairies, feel born strictly of somebody's wish to behold them. This recent work is unsettling in its insolent, sexual, and curdled sentimental kinks. But then so is Victorian fairy painting when you get in among the enchanted toadstools and think about it. You know which island nation sprouted the toadstools by a prevalent archness that daunts aesthetic contemplation. Britons have rarely taken comfortably to arts that set a premium on self-forgetful sincerity, painting, cooking. Their genius tends toward the self-consciously performative, theater, gardening. When they picture something, they can't seem to help picturing themselves picturing it, and the result is some species of caricature. Francis Bacon made a howling spectacle of trying in vain to destroy this loop. As it happens, fairy painting may be defined as a hybrid of theater and gardening, with a bonus harvest of Anglo-sexual hysteria. Lewis Carroll claimed to have counted 165 fairies in the nocturnal garden of the Scotsman Joseph Patton's Gaga, 1849, The Quarrel of Oberon and Titania. I love it. Mathematics and Mythomania. Act Brit. The quarrel parades the surface of lovely literary conceit and finicky technique that would make Victorian styles, from Patton's academic folderol to the obsessive scrumptiousness of the Pre-Raphaelites, bugbears of 20th century taste. This picture bloats with potted longueurs and show-offy effects. But you know what? It's fun. Let's suspend over-educated judgment for a moment and just gaze. What are those 165 fairies, I take Dr. Dodgson's word, up to? Gambling, for the most part, indulging in something like sex, the something like being key. The Victorians perfected anti-sensual nudity, nakedness plus attitude. Attitude puts arousal on hold. Performing erotically, the fairies take no evident note of one another's performance, so sex can't start. It is quite a feat, explicitly orgiastic goings-on, shot through with dream and story that are fit for parlor delectation. Why not be impressed? Speaking of Pre-Raphaelites, we find in this show the only fairy painting by John Everett Millais, Ferdinand Lured by Ariel, 1849. It presents a stagily tunicked and slippered, little the worse for shipwreck, Ferdinand, harking to a naked child of a punkishly green-haired Ariel who is borne aloft by greenish, bat-like, highly uningratiating fairies. With pre-wrath cloisonné fuss, Millais draws tedious attention to individual blades of grass and to Ferdinand's embroidered footwear. I mean, so what? But he conveys a keenly satisfying take on Shakespeare with his unusually but plausibly scary, malicious Ariel. I've never seen Ariel played that way. Like, you know, the little sociopath. It's good. It could work. It could play. The Tempest and A Midsummer Night's Dream came in for heavy illustrating by the fairy painters, and so did motifs from and for ballet. This was the era of wafting sylphs and daintily galumphing willies. Then there was opium. The tacit collaborator in John Anstruther Fitzgerald's paintings of drugged sleepers swarmed by creatures from bad neighborhoods of Nod. Not until the late 1960s would pharmacologically induced hallucination again command such popular prestige. And then there was madness. Charles Altamont Doyle, the father of Arthur Conan Doyle, died of epilepsy in a lunatic asylum in 1893. His watercolor-tinted drawings of frolicsome fairies fall short of delighting. They have a mentally hectic, emotionally numbed air that is familiar from the work of some untaught, often institutionalized artists who are termed outsiders. To Victorian tastes, outside could be as good as in. Charles had a career, though nothing like that of his brother, the vastly successful fairy painter Richard Doyle, who died at 59 of a stroke. But the premier mad painter of Victoria's reign, and perhaps ever, was Richard Dodd, who did his dad in. Want to hear that again? No. Having murdered the old man in, that's a gift, you know. Having murdered the old man in 1843, Dodd fled to France and was arrested after stabbing a fellow stagecoach passenger while on a self-appointed errand to assassinate the Emperor of Austria. He passed 2 decades in Bedlam, where he was allowed to paint. His pictures are illustrational in the Victorian vein, but the best of them, notably a talismanic little item from the Tate in London, the Fairy Feller's Master Stroke, are also as dense and worrisome as uranium. Viewed voyeuristically through tangled timothy grasses in a darkling gray-green underbrush, the tiny woodsman Feller prepares to axe a hazelnut. Gray-fleshed royals and commoners of a minuscule realm, attended by somewhat lugubrious fairies and a brass band, watch with impassive approval. One needn't be a vulgar Freudian to square this business of busting nuts with Dodd's parasitical rap sheet. Diagnostic readings of art are boring, though, and the fairy feller does not bore. Looking at it can be a euphoric ordeal. You keep wanting to turn the lights up. I suppose that Dodd had moonlight in mind, but the leaden illumination hints at something rarer, maybe a solar eclipse. Details we don't care about, like some daisies, glow lividly, while significant figures founder in murk. The difficulty of seeing feels symbolic of a deeper malaise, a difficulty of being. The feller is set to strike. It is okay for him to strike. The sinisterly glamorous moment tingles with held-breath tension. Nothing happens. The painting is not pretty. Dad's 9 years of labor on it left a surface untempting to the touch. His fairies are plainly the spawn less of air than of soil, Calibanettes. But the work's very grotesquery guarantees its appeal to contemporary sensibilities. It bespeaks invisible things that someone needed very badly to make visible. Painting is the medium of the need to see. It is also a medium of the hand, which is the organic emblem of individuality and sincerity. When you paint, your hand distills matter from the rest of you, senses, brain, heart, guts, genitals, soul. Modern art doted on the distilling process while suppressing interest in you, me, or anybody else. Modern art was impersonal. Today, with fairies in our faces, we recognize ever more strongly that modern art is over. For a while, at least, art's future returns to the control of artists, whose quirks and yens, the bases of our trust in them, will govern a search for fresh joys. From art today, we crave discriminations as specific as, say, the difference between an elf and a goblin, and between this elf here and that elf over there. Artists who are bewitched in novel, persuasive, exact ways will lead us on. Thank you. I'll stay over here.
Thanks. Okay, thanks to Peter and Edward for those presentations. The way this works, if you don't know, is put your hand up. We'll get a mic to you. Please wait for the mic so everyone can hear the question. Who would like to start us off? In the third row here in the white.
My question is for Mr. Sheldow. I know your position on the proposed Barnes move is that one molecule not be altered. Could you elaborate a little bit on that and include what you might suggest doing at this point to stop this debacle?
The Barnes, I think a trillionaire should, you know, swoom into town and give everybody enough money so they're all happy and leave it just as it is. It doesn't seem like it's going to happen, you know. And, I don't know. I mean, I love the Barnes just exactly as it is. There's only one of them in the universe. One minus one is none. And there are lots of museums, you know, with Cezannes to look at. I don't know. But I'm not going to argue. You know, there are many arguments in its favor. It's been very badly run. It's a tragedy, but in a world of tragedies, it's not on a scale with the death of a little girl. I mean, you know, it seems like a done deal. So I'd say get used to it. I mean, mourn it. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I hate it. I hate it, you know. Anyway, I'm sorry. How can I round this out beautifully? I can't. I'm going to have to let it slide.
We'll just take another question. Is there one? Yes, right here.
Hi. In regards to Van Meegeren's work, what did he do to make it appear old, and wasn't it put up to any like sort of scientific examination at the time?
Van Meegeren had prepared himself for scientific tests, but no one did any until after the truth came out. To my surprise, it turns out that science is hardly ever called into play, even today when the scientific techniques available have grown vastly more powerful. I had a hard time understanding that because prices have gone up all the time. People would pay millions or tens of millions, and you still don't test. And I kept asking why. It turns out essentially that the reason that you don't is that the person who's about to buy the painting that will be the greatest of his collection has fallen in love with that painting. And at the point when you're in love and you covet something, in human relationships, when you're newly smitten and everything is wine and candlelight, at that point no one hires a private detective. It's only years later when things go wrong. It turns out to apply to art as well. Van Meegeren, nonetheless, went to considerable trouble to withstand any tests if tests came along. It's easy to make a canvas that will be old if someone tests it. What you do is buy a genuinely old secondhand painting and scrape off the paint and paint on that. He did that. It's easy to make paints according to the formulations that Rembrandt and Vermeer and the others did. That's written down, these recipes. You take eye of newt and ear of bat and you stir together. That knowledge is available. The hard thing to do with a painting that's 3 months old, like this one that we looked at, to take a painting 3 months old and make it appear 300 years old, you can't simulate the passing, or you can't speed up the passing of time. How do you make that time pass? As an oil painting ages, it hardens, but it hardens terribly slowly. It takes years or decades. Van Meegeren didn't have years or decades, so what he did was buy a pizza oven, paint a strip of canvas, stuff it in the oven, guess at a temperature, guess at a timing, because you can't look that up in a handbook. And if the piece of painted canvas burst into flame, that was too long. If nothing happened, it was too short. Years went by. He wasn't getting anywhere. To make a long story short, there was an American inventor at the time who had invented the niftiest thing ever. It was this inexpensive stuff that had beautiful colors. It could be shaped. It didn't melt. Get ruined if it did melt. This was called plastic. Van Meegeren heard about this. He incorporates plastic into his paints, and now he's got a paint that keeps its color in the oven, that gets hard quickly. And so these paintings that fooled the world, these paintings that were supposedly done in the 1650s, were done in the 1930s with plastic paint.
Peter, have you ever knowingly reviewed or unknowingly reviewed forgeries?
Forgery? Gosh, I don't know. This is not an area in which I'm at all expert. I've had my suspicions about things, you know. I remember it was a lot of fun. Well, remember the when the Rembrandt gang started, you know, of running around the world declaring disattributing Rembrandt's. Rembrandt, you know, the Rembrandt of 1910 painted thousands of paintings, you know. The Rembrandt of today paints, you know, a couple hundred. We had great debates about it, and I was right on most of them. The Polish writer in the Frick, there was a lot of controversy over that, and I decided that, yeah, it's by Rembrandt, because if it weren't by Rembrandt, we would know who it was by, and that person would be as famous as Rembrandt. This is not a question that's going to get the best out of me. So.
We'll go to another question, then. Gentleman in black on our right.
You ended the story about Vermeer saying, at the end, the painter said it's the same painting, nothing has changed. Question I have is, who really determines what is good art and what isn't? Is it a critic who suddenly finds a new painter and says, gee, this guy is great, and everybody rushes to agree with him? 3 years later, somebody else said, he's not good? Can you answer that, please?
This is a question for Peter.
Okay. Yeah. somebody said somebody once said you can, you know, it's if you're it's like an art. There's somebody running with a ball, you know, and you keep running down the sideline and say, he doesn't have the ball, he doesn't have the ball, and suddenly he doesn't have the ball. I don't know. It's a matter of consensus. But I don't know, good and bad. I'm not ready for this. I just had this meal. It was a really fast meal. It's a Four Seasons, which was incredibly delicious, and I was stuffing it in like Coney Island, you know. Everybody gets to say, you know, but I think the least interesting thing to do with art is to go around rating it, you know. It's like, the top 10, you know, the top 10 nudes, you know, seen from the left. I don't know. It's, you know, if it does something for you, then it's a value to you. And you might, we're talking about taste. Taste, which is a residue of aesthetic experience. It, you know, it's like a guide. It's sort of a kind of rule of thumb we have based on what we like that'll tell us what we like again in the future and what to stay away from. W.H. Auden is one of my favorite writers and influenced me, my thinking a lot. Said that there are a number of kinds of mature taste. Immature taste is no taste. I mean, when you're young, you're a gourmand. I mean, you're stuffing yourself on, if something tastes good, you want all of it, you work through it, in a way, I think, you know, really mature taste, you get back there again, you know. But he said that the judgments of mature taste are, I know this is good and I like it. Okay. I know this is good, but I don't like it. I know this is good and I don't like it now, but I think that with time I'll come to like it. I know this is trash, but I like it. Okay. And there was one other, I don't remember, but it was like, by the way, the penny drops when you realize he doesn't say, this is trash and I like it, but I think that with time I'll come to not like it. He thinks it is too miserable an attitude to look forward with eagerness to not liking something. You know, I mean, it's, life is hard enough, all right? I mean, anyone who waits on somebody else's judgment in terms of art is, you know, either got a financial interest or is just really got no guts, you know. And that's fine. There are a lot of people, nice people with no guts, okay? I know a lot and I write good. And so I will do my damnedest to make you think exactly as I do, you know. And but having done that, I don't stick around to see whether it works or not, because I'm on to the next, you know. I don't get paid by the scalp, you know. So and also, you know, I would never consult, right? I mean, it's like anybody who puts their money where my mouth is strictly, you know, on their own. Okay, you know, I change my mind, you know, they can't come crying to me. Okay, you know, it's like, all right. Well, this is fun.
Moving along, in the third row here in the middle, in the black sweater. If you wait for the mic, please.
Who's painting today? Who's lucky enough to have exposure to art critics that most impresses you?
Well, there. I guess there are people painting who don't have the luck to be exposed to art critics. I suppose there are, although there are hundreds of galleries in New York, many hundreds, and they got to change their shows every month. So a lot of stuff gets exposed. By the way, when I first came to New York in the 60s, there were a little pocket of galleries on Upper Madison Avenue, a little pocket on 57th Street. That was it. And, you know, And that was the scene in which, you know, pop art and minimalism burst, you know, onto that scene. And it didn't change right away. Then it expanded. And, oh, by the way, the current art boom is the third I've lived through. There was one in the 60s and one in the 80s. I've lived through three art booms and two busts. Okay? You know, and in 1970 and in 1990. I mean, this is, so I'm looking forward to a complete set in 1910. so you heard it here. I don't know. I'm very much, here's my book. On the cover is a detail of a painting by John Curran, who is a contemporary painter that I like very much. And by the way, I had in mind from the beginning, for a long time, I wanted this detail of that painting. It's called Thanksgiving. It's got, it leaves out, it's in the Tate in London now. It's got a turkey. It's got a raw turkey down here, which is the most incredible turkey ever painted. And it's a small class of it's not a lot of contestants there. But and I have no idea what it means or what it's about. It's completely mysterious to me. I think both of the women are his wife Rachel, but he doesn't know what it's about either. There are a lot of painters I like, and abstract painters, different kind. I like things I can't use up. I like things that I don't get through it. I don't get over it, you know. But I don't know. Painting has declined very much from its previous position as the queen of the arts, you know. I like to say that, you know, I love painting more than anything else, but sometimes it's like visiting your loved one in intensive care, you know. It's like, you still love them, but you can't pretend, you know, they're full of pep, okay? And they got the tubes and, you know. Anyway. So.
The second row here.
I was just curious. Did Hermann Göring ever find... Well, I guess he found out that what he had was not a real Vermeer. Does anyone ever know what his reaction was to that?
Yes, that's a good question. The story has a happy ending to that extent. At the end of the war... Göring is arrested. He's convicted as a war criminal. He's sentenced to be executed. He manages to get someone to smuggle poison to him and to commit suicide the day before. But a week or two before his death, he was bragging to one of his American captors that he had at least accumulated the greatest collection of art that any one man ever had. And what was even more remarkable, in all that collection, there wasn't a single fake. By now, this story had come out, and so his American captor was able to say, well, let me tell you. And in satisfying fashion, Göring is furious and indignant. He's red-faced. He leaps to attack. The guards have to pull him back. So we have that small consolation, at least.
And on that happy note, we're going to have to wrap it up, folks. Please join me in thanking Peter and Edward. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.